You know, it's easy to talk about trusting God when we are able to do things in our own strength, when the answer is something that that we see the answer to, and we have clear direction. You know, when some difficulty befalls you and the path is clear, it's easy to say, well, we're just going to trust God and everything's going to be all right. But it's another thing to trust God when the outcome is in question, when we don't know what's going to happen, when we are faced with hardship, when we are faced with unexplainable circumstances or even things that are completely out of our control. I was talking to a friend the other day who's going through just some significant legal troubles. And he said, you know, the hardest part is just knowing what to do and how to plan. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if this is going to be expensive. I don't know if this is going to end up in jail. I don't know what's going to happen. And so he is in the midst of dealing with all that, trying to assure his family that everything's okay and that everything will be all right. But the reality is he just really doesn't know. And so no matter how much he tries to assert confidence, the truth is that he's not innocent in the situation and he knows it. And he cannot just say to his family, it's all going to be all right, even though he believes ultimately that it will be, that God is in control and that even in the midst of his really bad decisions, that God is for him, that God loves him nonetheless, and that God certainly loves his family and he continues to pray for them. The question in really difficult circumstances is how we will respond. You see, one of the things that's intriguing to me over and over again is that the scripture never paints a picture for us and the idea that when we come to Christ, all of our problems go away. I know a lot of TV preachers who say things like that. I know a lot of people who feel like it's their job to assure people. But I think the thing is that when we do that, that we really mislead people, and that oftentimes their greatest disappointment with God is not God's fault, but us as pastors who tell everybody everything's going to be all right, that, or we make them feel like if you just come to Jesus, all your problems go away. And while there's a lot of truth that when I come to Christ, that I find comfort, I find peace, I find hope to deal with my trials and my difficulties, it doesn't mean they go away. It just means that I have someone to lean on in the midst of those trials and circumstances. And so oftentimes the picture that is painted when trying to explain this whole thing is, will you be a thermometer or a thermostat? You know, when you go over to the thermostat, the nice thing about a thermostat has that button, you know, and you can push it up or you can push it down and you can change the temperature in the room as long as everything's working. I say that because sometimes you push the button and nothing's working, so it doesn't really make much difference. But most of the time, you walk over to the thermostat, and you can set it to cool, and you can turn the temperature down, you can crank it down, and you can make it nice and chilly, even though it's really hot out there. I love it when it's hot out there. Can I just tell you that? I'm just really enjoying this weather. I don't know if anybody else is, but I'm enjoying it. So, and then in the wintertime, when it gets really cold out there, you know, I don't mean like Michigan cold, but I mean when it gets like even Florida cold, and it's chilly, and I can go in the house and I can find that thermostat and I can turn it to heat, and I can push that button up, you know, to something like 80 degrees. No, you can push that button up and get it nice and warm in the house. So you walk outside, and even though it's cold outside, baby, it's cold outside. Inside, it's nice and warm, but a thermometer does none of that. A thermometer is something you scan across the forehead for everybody today, or you stick in your mouth or elsewhere, and that tells you what the temperature is. It reflects the temperature. If you lay it on the counter and you come back, it will tell you what temperature the room is. If you stick it in your mouth, it'll tell you what temperature your body is. But it can't change the temperature. It's not its point. Now, they usually include one of each on a thermostat. It tells you what the temperature is so that you can adjust the temperature accordingly and make yourself feel better. It is a great privilege to be a human being at the top of the food chain and have the powers of being able to build things like air conditioning and heating and all that. What a great blessing we have. I know my dog is really grateful that we created air conditioning. Hello? But the question for you and I is are we a thermostat or a thermometer? Do we reflect the condition of the room or do we set the condition of the room? Now, before David was ever crowned king, the unique thing about David was that he was a thermostat. When you look at the life of David, from our first introduction to him to the closing chapters, David changed the temperature in the room. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But he was a thermostat. There's no doubt about it. King David was a game changer, not only from the standpoint of his people immediately around him, but in terms of you look at his scope and his influence throughout the scriptures and the references to him, even in the New Testament. On the other hand, King Saul is the absolute epitome of what a thermometer looks like. He blamed his troops when things didn't go well. He blamed his troops for his own moral failings. He took his cues from opinion polls. Well, they didn't want to. They didn't like that. They didn't. And he always was constantly explaining away everything he did by the condition of things around him. When he was in impossible circumstances, he always chose to follow the crowd rather than to follow God. He is the epitome of the cowardice of men. David, in contrast, when he found his men defeated, would rally his troops, would oftentimes change the circumstances when his men were feeling defeated. Even when he realized that his own actions one time were defeating his men, he just kind of stuck a sock in it, sucked it up, and went out and encouraged the men and got them to move on from stuck where they were, even though internally he was suffering greatly. He chose action while others stood in the fear of a giant. He spoke up when others were silent. And today, we're going to look at that very famous text of David in combat with Goliath, with the giant Goliath. It's a well-worn text, but it is nevertheless true. As we continue to fit this series on finishing well, you and I cannot finish well if our eyes are on our problems rather than the God who is able to overcome those problems. The way we finish well is we keep our eyes on him. With that said, let's read in 1 Samuel chapter 17 this morning, beginning in verse 1. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. My favorite translation, the one is in your lap. That's the best one there is. Let's read along together. And like I said, I will be reading from the English Standard Version. That's what's on the screens overhead. But please read in whatever translation you have. And so now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they gathered at Succoth, and which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes-Damon. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah. And they drew up lines of battle against the Philistines, and the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was about 6 cubits in a span. He held a helmet of bronze on his head, and his arms were coated with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had a bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like that of a weaver's beam, and his spearhead weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me, if he is able, to fight with me and kill me. Then we will be your servants." But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. And the Philistines said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And when Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephraimite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. And you thought you had a big family. And the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn. Next to him, Abinadab. And the 3rd, Shema. David was the youngest, making the point that he was not old enough for war. The 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. And Jesse said to David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their thousands. See if your brothers are well and bring back some token from them. Now Saul and they and all of the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. And as he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Translate, no taxes. Makes you want to go to war, doesn't it? No. And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away this reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul. And he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You are but a youth. He has been a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and I struck him and I delivered it out of his mouth. And if he rose against me, I caught him by the beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Then Saul clothed David with his armor, put a helmet of bronze on his head, and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped the sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David put them off, and he took his staff in his hand, and he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." And then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, in the name of Yahweh, the God of armies, or the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day Yahweh will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead body of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. Don't you love the way is all this prep leading up to this battle and like the battle is over in like 10 seconds? Kind of like a, you know, like any big festivity, right? So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran, stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose. Can you imagine? A boy just beat your champion. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued this Philistine as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on their way from Shaarim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. Well, you know, I just can't tell you that how happy I am that this text fell on Father's Day. Just seems like one of those kind of texts, you know, for Father's Day. I don't know. It just seemed that way to me. And, you know, one of the things that I think is so important about these stories as we talk about these is not only the whole issue of us finishing well and learning from the lives of these people, but, you know, it's so important for you and I to read these stories and put them in context that are devoid of all of the religious trappings that so often go along with these stories. Sometimes the way we've been told the stories, or we've gotten the Reader's Digest version, I mean literally a Reader's Digest version, or we've gotten it from a World Encyclopedia or something like that, maybe we've just heard people give us the short version and they've told the tale and left out some of the significant details and different things. We get sometimes, even though the majority of the details are there, we get a very different picture. One of those things about this is sometimes we get the picture as if there is that David is just a little boy. And I really like the way the ESV translates it there, youth. And the idea is this playing off between men of war and a young man. Actually, David's somewhere probably late teens to early 20s from what we know in terms of the timeline of his life. Saul has been a king now for almost 30 years, and we look at the last 10 years of Saul's reign till David takes the throne. David has already been anointed king at this point. Saul is unaware of that. The only people who know are his brothers. And note that the one brother, how easily offended he is at David. He was anointed in front of them, and they had a celebration meal with Samuel. And, of course, his brothers aren't going to say what happened, because I'm sure that they're thinking to themselves, this is our little brother. He is not going to rule over us. But we have this sometimes a picture of like this little boy that's 10 years old and he puts on this giant, you know, hat and he's stumbling around and it's, you know, a little boy. And that's maybe cute and trying to encourage young people that God can use them too. But what we're really looking at is the contrast between one who is very skilled for battle and ready for war and one who is not. And yet, it's not about what he does or doesn't have. It's about whom he puts his trust in and using what he does have rather than being worried about what he doesn't have. Now, one of the things that they try to solve right there is that you've just been described this incredible armor that is on Goliath. I mean, every inch of him is covered with metal. I imagine that he was extremely ominous and intimidating. Many people believe that Goliath was what we would call a Nephilim, that he was part human and part angelic, and that these were the champions of old. Others desupernaturalize that text, make him just a big man. Depending on some of the little footnotes in our text, you could guess he's somewhere between anywhere from 6'9 to 9'6, depending on how you interpret those things. And so either he's a really, really big guy or he's a really enormous big guy. I don't know which. Either way, the people in Israel who are seasoned warriors are afraid of this man. They're afraid of his armor. They're afraid of his skill. They're afraid to look at him. And they're accepting his conditions without any, like, at some point, why don't you just say, no, we are not going to do it like that because you have a clear advantage over any other man and we're just going to run you over while you're standing there. That's what we would do today. But they were like, oh, wow, he's offered this challenge and what are we going to do? And they're wringing their hands. And think about this. If he's only 6'9", so is Saul. Saul is head and shoulders taller than anyone in all of Israel. But Saul's not out there. And Saul is afraid. Everybody in Israel is afraid. And this man is standing out there, and it makes this interesting point that it says when he comes out that he defies them and he makes comments about their God. And here's David. This is what I love about David. This is why you and I need stories like David. It's why we need to grow up on these kinds of stories. It's why we need to repeat them to each other as adults. Because David's hope is not simply in his ability to deal with bears and lions, even though that gives him some sense of courage. But his hope is in the living God, and that how dare this man blaspheme God? That's what he's upset about. He's not saying, man, I can't believe that they said something about the United States of Israel. Hello? He's not saying, man, I can't believe that he would dare to defy our armies. He says, of the armies of God, of Yahweh God, he's drawing all the attention onto God. And in fact, in the text, what doesn't come through 100% very clear is that when he goes out and he goes to do the little mudslinging thing, because that's what guys got to do when they're getting ready to have a battle. You know, they got to front a little bit. And what does he say? It's in code, but it says essentially this. He throws down not God to Goliath, not God to the Philistines, but he throws down God to God. And it says that he defies the name of Dagon. He goes after him, God to God. He makes this all about the honor of God. So even though he's got a certain amount of bravery because he's dealt with bears and lions, but you do realize that David's brothers grew up fighting bears and lions too, right? I mean, like, they're shepherds. That's what shepherds do. I know we like to, like, you know, kind of paint tranquil scenes, and we call them pastoral scenes and things like that. And it's always the little lambs, you know, running on the greenery. And you know what a shepherd does? A shepherd defends the sheep and kills wolves and bears and lions. That's what a shepherd does. And that shepherd has had to do all those things. So have his brothers. See, it's not about the fact that he's been brave in the face of lions and tigers. It's that there's this sense in David, you will not defy the name of my God. You will not, because you see, when he comes out, he's not just threatening Israel. He's saying, your God is not able. And then he says vile things about Yahweh. He says, you're not going to say that. And here's the thing unfortunately, the way our text translated, we just use the capital Lord instead of using the personal name of God. He is using the personal name of God. That Philistine is saying Yahweh. And then he says all of his vile curses. He is defying God in every, it is personal. There is no God, whatever, the God of your personal understanding, like we do, you know. He's saying, your God, Yahweh, is a loser. He's a blah, 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 and he's being vile. And Israel's standing there going, whoa, whoa, what are we going to do? He's a big guy. What am I going to do? And David's not there but a few minutes, and he's like, you can't defy God like that. I know who my God is. You know what's cool? David hadn't even read the story about Daniel. Daniel's in the future. He had never read that story. You know what's really cool? The only thing that David's been able to read is in those first five books in the Torah. That's all he's had. And he's already figured out who God is and how God deals with the nations, how God deals with the armies, and what God does when he comes against Egypt. And he says, you know what? That's the God I know. That's the God I serve. And in the name of that God, of Yahweh God, I will either defeat this man or I will die trying, but there's no way that I am going to stand here in shame and allow that man to speak about my God that way. And so he does what is seemingly impossible. Now, he doesn't put on that armor because Saul 6'9". Okay, do we have anybody in here that's like 6'9"? Anybody? Got 6'5"? Somebody 6'5"? Anybody 6'5"? Okay, we got a 6'5". All right, just kind of come up here for me for just a moment. I don't mean to embarrass you, but I just kind of want to, like, help you with a little visual illustration, okay? Now, he's not a man of war. I'm not a man of war. But can you imagine me putting on his armor? I don't think I could even wear his shirt, okay? His trousers, you know? Thank you, Shannon, thank you. So let's do away with this kind of thing of this little boy in the helmet kind of standing there looking goofy and really start to think that David is preparing for war. And he puts on that helmet that's for Saul, and he puts on that shield that's for Saul, and he's like, what am I going to do? I don't know how to do this. And chainmail, and he's weighed down. He's never fought like that before. That's why he says, I haven't tested these. I don't know what to do with these. And instead of worrying about what he didn't have, he looked at what God had given him. He knew how he had battled the lion. He knew how he battled the bear. And he took the things that God had put in his hands. And that's what he went to war with. Do you know, church, one of the things that is one of the most crippling things in the church for us is that we worry about reaching out to our community, and we're worried about what money we don't have or what resources we don't have or what abilities we don't have. And all I can say to you is pick up the stones, pick up what God has put in your hand, pull out your sling. God is not looking for you to have the best equipment, the best tools, the best brains or anything else. God is asking you to take the tools that he has put in your life, the gifts that he has given you, and go to war. Go to war. Change the climate. Be a thermostat. Go into the workplace. I don't care if you're not the boss. You don't have to be the boss to change the climate. One of the things when I was working as a headhunter for a while, I was a missionary, and we, you know, our funds were up and down, and so I went to work in an international headhunting company. You know, one of the things that just intrigued me was that once I came to work there, that my son Tyler was working there in the back room, and he said, "Dad, since you've been working here," he says, "man, it used to be that four-letter words and foul jokes were just everywhere, and they would run around telling them and pass them around. And since you've been here, hardly anybody will say, they whisper them in quiet." I never said a word. I didn't ask anybody to do anything different. I knew where I was going to work. I already knew these people on a social level. I had been friends with a number of them, and they'd never stopped dropping the F-bomb in front of me at their house. But suddenly in the workplace, the climate began to change. It began to change the entire environment. We started praying during staff meetings. You have a choice. I wasn't the boss. I was the lowly missionary who was trying to make ends meet. And that they would send me on all the jobs that nobody wanted. Like Mexico. Nobody wanted to go to Mexico. So I would go to Mexico. You change the climate not by being the boss. You don't change the climate by having the most money. You don't change the climate by being the most powerful person in the room, the most charismatic person in the room. You change the climate by being who you are. You outlive them. I'm not saying that everybody around you is going to start. Let me tell you, they're still telling the jokes. And since I've left, they're telling the jokes again. And they're not in quiet anymore. But whose name do we go in? You see, we can stand in the corner and we can shake and we can be in fear and we can worry about what might happen to us. Or we can simply go in the confidence that God provides, take the gifts that we have, the abilities that we have, and minister not out of what we don't have, but out of who God already made you to be. Now, granted, David was handsome. Tells us that. And it said he had really pink cheeks. I don't know how ferocious that looks when you come up to the battle line with really pink cheeks. I'm guessing it's probably not very ferocious. We've got a couple of warriors in here. I bet if I asked them, it probably doesn't make them think ferocious when somebody walks up in with really pink cheeks. It's probably not very intimidating when someone walks up with a sling and a pouch and five stones. He wasn't trying to out-intimidate them. He just did with what God put in his hand. I'm certain of this. God has put things in your hands. You have gifts and abilities and talents. You have spheres of influence that you have the opportunity to use for the kingdom of God or the kingdom of self every day. The only question is whose kingdom you're building. One of the things that I think is dangerous for every pastor is to build the kingdom of self. Somebody said to me, so now it's become the running joke about trying to outpark me. If you weren't here, I always park way out. I don't like parking by the door and stuff. Something just deep inside me says that we're called to servant leadership, not to be the superstar. And so something just about being by the door just irks me to a degree I can't explain. And so I purposely park out there. And somebody said to me later, "I think it's okay that you park by the door. You're in and out more than anybody." And I said, that's not the point. The point isn't whether it's okay for me to park by the door. The point is for me to remind myself as I park at the other end of the building and I walk by your cars and I see your faces and remember that why I'm parked here in the first place. I'm not here for me alone. I'm not here because the vineyard is here. I'm here to be with you and to serve you and to do what God has given me to do in this city. And church, you are where you are. You're in the school you're in. You're in the post office you're in. You're in the fire station you're in. You're in the army unit you're in. You're in the neighborhood that you're in. You are in the school that you're in. Whatever it is that God is doing with you, God has put you in that place to be his warrior, to be his man, to be the one who stands for what is right, and not really to be worried about the outcome as much as to just simply trust him. It's not so that you can preach at them and belittle them or anything. I'm talking about outliving people. And to remember who the real enemy is. You see, the real enemy isn't Goliath. That's not what David did. What, it wasn't about cursing Goliath. It was about cursing Dagon and Baal. It wasn't about personal offense. It wasn't that David felt so personally, I'm just so offended. It wasn't about his personal offense. It was that he had defied the name of the God of Israel, Yahweh. And he wasn't going to stand for that. It wasn't okay. And you know, when you and I are out there in the workplace, it doesn't take long for people to figure out whose side we're on. Whether we're on our side or God's side. I don't say our side or their side because you know what? There isn't a their side. It's really, that's totally irrelevant. Their side is their individual side. It's everybody for himself. That is the nature of the world. To be all about yourself. We say it all the time. Well, if you don't take care of number one. Oh, you said it too, huh? Yeah. But David says, it's all about God. And in the end, church, if you and I are really going to finish well, then in the times of trial and circumstance, we surrender it all to him. When things are going well and we're able to do the things that we look and we still say, all glory belongs to him. And we trust him and we put all of our eggs in his basket because he is able. He's able. See, the reason you don't put all the eggs in your own basket is because I promise you'll crack them up. The reason you don't put all your eggs in your company's basket is, I promise, they will crack them up. The reason you don't put all your eggs in anybody else's basket is they are not able. But he is. So I put all my eggs in his basket. It's all about you, God. You are the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega, and this is where I put my trust. And David, what makes him such an incredible warrior, what made him such an incredible king, what changed the course of Israel was that David had a heart after God. That's what God's calling you to have. It's why he's gifted you and put you together and made you the way you are so that you can demonstrate his heart to the world around you. Let's stand together. As I said before, we're going to have a little extra time of worship, so I hope that you will stay and enjoy that extra time of worship there. I'm going to ask if I can get our prayer team members, if I can get a couple of teams up here and a team in the back. And, you know, when you and I go out into the community to make a difference, it's really easy to feel defeated even before you start. you can notice the ways in which others are maybe prettier than I am, or they're smarter than I am, or maybe they're more wealthy. Maybe they have more talents. There's always this sense of comparing. You know, there's nothing more that's the devil's workshop than comparing yourselves to other people. You know what I found out? That even the most beautiful people don't know how beautiful they really are. That even the smartest people don't have any idea of really how smart they are. And they're always comparing themselves to someone else too. It is the devil's workshop to compare. It will destroy all of your hopes, all of your dreams. It will keep you out of the places that God wants to take you. So this morning, as we close out in worship, we've got prayer teams available for you. Maybe this morning, if you already are feeling like you lack or you're not able, maybe you would come and pray with one of these teams and pray that God would break that sense of fear off of you, that God would take away that comparison that is so trapping you and keeping you from doing all that God has for you. Maybe this morning you're in a place where you've never walked with the Lord Jesus before, and you don't want to know, how do I begin this life of living for God and with God? And I know that those prayer teams would love to visit with you about how to begin a walk with Jesus this morning. Maybe you just something that God is doing in your heart and life today. Maybe you need some prayer for physical things, or for maybe some financial needs have come your way and you just already feel defeated. You don't know where it's going to come from. You don't know how God will deliver you. And you're saying, God, there is nothing in my hands. What will you put in my hands today so that I can win the battle? And maybe it's the things of your own doing. And what you need to know today is that his mercy is abundant for you. That it's not because you are deserving, but because he loves you, that he rescues. Let's worship the Lord together.